The Control of Press, Radio, Films. Every morning, the editors of the Berlin daily newspapers and the correspondents of those published elsewhere in the Reich gathered at the propaganda ministry to be told by Dr. Goebbels or by one of his aides what news to print and suppress, how to write the news and headline it, what campaigns to call off or institute, and what editorials were desired for the day. In case of any misunderstanding, a daily written directive was furnished along with the oral instructions. For the smaller out-of-town papers and the periodicals, the directives were dispatched by telegram or by mail. To be an editor in the Third Reich, one had to be, in the first place, politically and racially clean. The Reich Press Law of October 4, 1933, which made journalism a public vocation, regulated by law, stipulated that all editors must possess German citizenship, be of Aryan descent, and not married to a Jew. Section 14 of the press law ordered editors to keep out of the newspapers anything which in any manner is misleading to the public, mixes selfish aims with community aims, tends to weaken the strength of the German Reich, outwardly or inwardly, the common will of the German people, the defense of Germany, its culture and economy, or offends the honor and dignity of Germany. An edict which, if it had been in effect before 1933, would have led to the suppression of every Nazi editor and publication in the country. It now led to the ousting of those journals and journalists who were not Nazi or who declined it to become so. One of the first to be forced out of business was the Vossische Zeitung. Founded in 1704 and numbering among its contributors in the past such names as Frederick the Great, Lessing, and Rathenau, it had become the leading newspaper of Germany, comparable to the Times of London and the New York Times. But it was liberal, and it was owned by the House of Ullstein, a Jewish firm. It went out of business on April 1, 1934, after 230 years of continuous publication. The Berliner Tageblatt, another world-renowned liberal newspaper, lingered on a little longer until 1937, though its owner, Hans Lachmann Mosse, a Jew, was forced to surrender his interest in the newspaper in the spring of 1933. Germany's third great liberal newspaper, the Frankfurter Zeitung, also continued to publish after divesting itself of its Jewish proprietor and editors. Rudolf Kircher, its London correspondent, an Anglophile and a liberal, became the editor, and, like Karl Zielex, editor of the conservative Deutsche Allgemeine Zeitung of Berlin, who had also been a London correspondent, a Rhodes Scholar, a passionate admirer of the British and a liberal, served the Nazis well, often becoming, as Otto Dietrich, the Reich press chief, once said of the former opposition papers, more papal than the Pope. That the last three newspapers survived was due partly to the influence of the German Foreign Office, which wanted these internationally known journals as a kind of showpiece to impress the outside world. They gave a respectability to Nazi Germany and at the same time peddled its propaganda. With all newspapers in Germany being told what to publish and how to write the news and editorials, it was inevitable that a deadly conformity would come over the nation's press. Even a people so regimented and so given to accepting authority became bored by the daily newspapers. Circulation declined even for the leading Nazi daily newspapers, such as the morning Völkischer Beobachter and the evening Der Angriff. And the total circulation of all journals fell off steeply as one paper after another went under or was taken over by Nazi publishers. In the first 4 years of the Third Reich, the number of daily newspapers declined from 3,607 to 2,671. But the country's loss of a free and varied press was the party's gain, at least financially. Max Amann, Hitler's top sergeant during the First World War and head of the Eir Verlag, the party's publishing firm, became the financial dictator of the German press. As Reich leader for the press and president of the press chamber, he had the legal right to suppress any publication he pleased and the consequent power to buy it up for a song. In a short time, the Eir Verlag became a gigantic publishing empire, probably the largest and most lucrative in the world. Amann's own income skyrocketed from 108,000 marks in 1934 to 3,800,000 marks in 1942. Letter to the author from Professor Oren J. Hale, who has made a study of the surviving records of the Nazi publishing firm. Despite the drop in sales of many Nazi publications, the daily newspapers owned or controlled by the party or individual Nazis had two-thirds of the total daily circulation of 25 million by the time of the outbreak of the Second War. In an affidavit made at Nuremberg, Amann described how he operated. After the party came to power in 1933, many of these concerns, such as the Ullstein House, which were owned or controlled by Jewish interests or by political or religious interests hostile to the Nazi Party, found it expedient to sell their newspapers or assets to the Eyre concern. There was no free market for the sale of such properties, and the Eyre Verlag was generally the only bidder. In this matter, the Eyre Verlag, together with publishing concerns owned or controlled by it, expanded into a monopoly of the newspaper publishing business in Germany. The party investment in these publishing enterprises became financially very successful. It is a true statement to say that the basic purpose of the Nazi press program was to eliminate all the press which was in opposition to the party. At one period in 1934, both Amann and Goebbels appealed to the obsequious editors to make their papers less monotonous. Amann said he deplored the present far-reaching uniformity of the press, which is not a product of government measures and does not conform to the will of the government. One rash editor, Aim Welke, of the weekly Grüne Post, made the mistake of taking Amann and Goebbels seriously. He chided the propaganda ministry for its red tape and for the heavy hand with which it held down the press and made it so dull. His publication was promptly suspended for 3 months, and he himself dismissed by Goebbels and carted off to a concentration camp. The radio and the motion pictures were also quickly harnessed to serve the propaganda of the Nazi state. Goebbels had always seen in radio, television had not yet come in, the chief instrument of propaganda in modern society, and through the radio department of his ministry and the Chamber of Radio, he gained complete control of broadcasting and shaped it to his own ends. His task was made easier because in Germany, as in the other countries of Europe, broadcasting was a monopoly owned and operated by the state. In 1933, the Nazi government automatically found itself in possession of the Reich Broadcasting Corporation. The films remained in the hands of private firms, but the propaganda ministry and the Chamber of Films controlled every aspect of the industry. Their task being, in the words of an official commentary, to lift the film industry out of the sphere of liberal economic thoughts and thus enable it to receive those tasks which it has to fulfill in the National Socialist State. The result in both cases was to afflict the German people with radio programs and motion pictures as inane and boring as were the contents of their daily newspapers and periodicals. Even a public which usually submitted without protest to being told what was good for it revolted. The customers stayed away in droves from the Nazi films and jammed the houses which showed the few foreign pictures, mostly B-grade Hollywood, which Goebbels permitted to be exhibited on German screens. At one period in the mid-30s, the hissing of German films became so common that Wilhelm Frick, the Minister of the Interior, issued a stern warning against treasonable behavior on the part of cinema audiences. Likewise, the radio programs were so roundly criticized that the president of the radio chamber, one Horst Dressler Andres, declared that such carping was an insult to German culture and would not be tolerated. In those days, in the 30s, a German listener could still turn his dial to a score of foreign radio stations without, as happened later when the war began, risking having his head chopped off. And perhaps quite a few did, though it was this observer's impression that as the years went by, Dr. Goebbels proved himself right, in that the radio became by far the regime's most effective means of propaganda, doing more than any other single instrument of communication to shape the German people to Hitler's ends. I myself was to experience how easily one is taken in by a lying and censored press and radio in a totalitarian state. Though unlike most Germans, I had daily access to foreign newspapers, especially those of London, Paris, and Zurich, which arrived the day after publication, and though I listened regularly to the BBC and other foreign broadcasts, my job necessitated the spending of many hours a day in combing the German press, checking the German radio, conferring with Nazi officials, and going to party meetings. It was surprising and sometimes consternating to find that notwithstanding the opportunities I had to learn the facts, and despite one's inherent distrust of what one learned from Nazi sources, A steady diet over the years of falsifications and distortions made a certain impression on one's mind and often misled it. No one who has not lived for years in a totalitarian land can possibly conceive how difficult it is to escape the dread consequences of a regime's calculated and incessant propaganda. Often in a German home or office, or sometimes in a casual conversation with a stranger in a restaurant, a beer hall, a cafe, I would meet with the most outlandish assertions from seemingly educated and intelligent persons. It was obvious that they were parroting some piece of nonsense they had heard on the radio or read in the newspapers. Sometimes one was tempted to say as much, but on such occasions one was met with such a stare of incredulity, such a shock of silence, as if one had blasphemed the Almighty, that one realized how useless it was even to try to make contact with a mind which had become warped, and for whom the facts of life had become what Hitler and Goebbels, with their cynical disregard for truth, said they were. Education in the Third Reich. On April 30, 1934, Bernhard Rust, an Obergruppenführer in the SA, one-time Gauleiter of Hanover, a Nazi party member and friend of Hitler since the early 20s, was named Reich Minister of Science, Education, and Popular Culture. In the bizarre, topsy-turvy world of National Socialism, Rust was eminently fitted for this task. Since 1930, he had been an unemployed provincial schoolmaster, having been dismissed in that year by the local Republican authorities at Hanover for certain manifestations of instability of mind, though his fanatical Nazism may have been partly responsible for his ouster. For Dr. Rust preached the Nazi gospel with the zeal of a Goebbels and the fuzziness of a Rosenberg. Named Prussian Minister of Science, Art, and Education in February 1933, he boasted that he had succeeded overnight in liquidating the school as an institution of intellectual acrobatics. To such a mindless man was now entrusted dictatorial control over German science, the public schools, the institutions of higher learning, and the youth organizations. For education in the Third Reich, as Hitler envisaged it, was not to be confined to stuffy classrooms, but to be furthered by a Spartan political and martial training in the successive youth groups, and to reach its climax not so much in the universities and engineering colleges, which absorbed but a small minority, but first at the age of 18 in compulsory labor service, and then in service as conscripts in the armed forces. Hitler's contempt for professors and the intellectual academic life had peppered the pages of Mein Kampf, in which he had set down some of his ideas on education. The whole education by a national state, he had written, must aim primarily not at the stuffing with mere knowledge, but at building bodies which are physically healthy to the core. But even more important, he had stressed in his book the importance of winning over and then training the youth in the service of a new national state, a subject he returned to often after he became the German dictator. When an opponent declares, "I will not come over to your side," he said in a speech on November 6, 1933, "I calmly say, your child belongs to us already. What are you? You will pass on. Your descendants, however, now stand in the new camp. In a short time they will know nothing else but this new community." And on May 1, 1937, he declared, "This new Reich will give its youth to no one, but will itself take youth and give to youth its own education and its own upbringing." It was not an idle boast. That was precisely what was happening. The German schools, from first grade through the universities, were quickly Nazified. Textbooks were hastily rewritten, curricula were changed, Mein Kampf was made, in the words of Der Deutsche Erzieher, official organ of the educators, our infallible pedagogical guiding star, and teachers who failed to see the new light were cast out. Most instructors had been more or less Nazi in sentiment when not outright party members. To strengthen their ideology, they were dispatched to special schools for intensive training in National Socialist principles, emphasis being put on Hitler's racial doctrines. Every person in the teaching profession, from kindergarten through the universities, was compelled to join the National Socialist Teachers League, which, by law, was held responsible for the execution of the ideological and political coordination of all teachers in accordance with the National Socialist doctrine. The Civil Service Act of 1937 required teachers to be the executors of the will of the party-supported state, and to be ready at any time to defend without reservation the National Socialist state. An earlier decree had classified them as civil servants and thus subject to the racial laws. Jews, of course, were forbidden to teach. All teachers took an oath to be loyal and obedient to Adolf Hitler. Later, no man could teach who had not first served in the SA, the labor service, or the Hitler Youth. Candidates for instructorships in the universities had to attend for 6 weeks an observation camp, where their views and character were studied by Nazi experts and reported to the Ministry of Education, which issued licenses to teach based on the candidate's political reliability. Prior to 1933, the German public schools had been under the jurisdiction of the local authorities and the universities under that of the individual states. Now all were brought under the iron rule of the Reich Minister of Education. It was he who also appointed the rectors and deans of the universities, who formerly had been elected by the full professors of the faculty. He also appointed the leaders of the University Students' Union, to which all students had to belong, and of the Lecturers' Union, comprising all instructors. The NS Association of University Lecturers, under the tight leadership of old Nazi hands, was given a decisive role in selecting who was to teach and to see that what they taught was in accordance with Nazi theories. The result of so much Nazification was catastrophic for German education and for German learning. History was so falsified in the new textbooks and by the teachers in their lectures that it became ludicrous. The teaching of the racial sciences, exalting the Germans as the master race and the Jews as breeders of almost all the evil there was in the world, was even more so. In the University of Berlin alone, where so many great scholars had taught in the past, the new rector, a stormtrooper and by profession a veterinarian, instituted 25 new courses in Rassenkunde, racial science, and by the time he had really taken the university apart, he had 86 courses connected with his own profession. The teaching of the natural sciences, in which Germany had been so preeminent for generations, deteriorated rapidly. Great teachers such as Einstein and Frank in physics, Haber, Willstetter and Warburg in chemistry were fired or retired. Those who remained, many of them, were bitten by the Nazi aberrations and attempted to apply them to pure science. They began to teach what they called German physics, German chemistry, German mathematics. Indeed, in 1937 there appeared a journal called Deutsche Mathematik, and its first editorial solemnly proclaimed that any idea that mathematics could be judged non-racially carried within itself the germs of destruction of German science. The hallucinations of these Nazi scientists became unbelievable, even to a layman. "German physics?" asked Professor Philipp Lehnart of Heidelberg University, who was one of the more learned and internationally respected scientists of the Third Reich. "But," it will be replied, "science is and remains international. It is false. In reality, science, like every other human product, is racial and conditioned by blood." Professor Rudolf Tomaschek, director of the Institute of Physics at Dresden, went further. "Modern physics," he wrote, "is an instrument of world Jewry for the destruction of Nordic science. True physics is the creation of the German spirit. In fact, all European science is the fruit of Aryan, or better, German, thought." Professor Johannes Stark, head of the German National Institute of Physical Science, thought so too. It would be found, he said, that the founders of research in physics and the great discoverers from Galileo to Newton to the physical pioneers of our time were almost exclusively Aryan, predominantly of the Nordic race. There was also Professor Wilhelm Müller of the Technical College of Aachen, who in a book entitled Jewry and Science saw a worldwide Jewish plot to pollute science and thereby destroy civilization. To him, Einstein, with his theory of relativity, was the arch-villain. The Einstein theory, on which so much of modern physics is based, was to this singular Nazi professor directed from beginning to end toward the goal of transforming the living, that is, the non-Jewish, world of living essence, born from a mother earth and bound up with blood, and bewitching it into spectral abstraction, in which all individual differences of peoples and nations and all inner limits of the races are lost in unreality, and in which only an unsubstantial diversity of geometric dimensions survives, which produces all events out of the compulsion of its godless subjection to laws. The worldwide acclaim given to Einstein on the publication of his theory of relativity, Professor Müller proclaimed, was really only a rejoicing over the approach of Jewish world rule, which was to force down German manhood irrevocably and eternally to the level of the lifeless slave. To Professor Ludwig Bieberbach of the University of Berlin, Einstein was an alien mountebank. Even to Professor Lenart, the Jew conspicuously lacks understanding for the truth, being in this respect in contrast to the Aryan research scientist with his careful and serious will to truth. Jewish physics is thus a phantom and a phenomenon of degeneration of fundamental German physics. And yet, from 1905 to 1931, 10 German Jews had been awarded Nobel Prizes for their contributions to science. During the Second Reich, the university professors, like the Protestant clergy, had given blind support to the conservative government and its expansionist aims, and the lecture halls had been breeding grounds of virulent nationalism and anti-Semitism. The Weimar Republic had insisted on complete academic freedom, and one result had been that the vast majority of university teachers, anti-liberal, anti-democratic, anti-Semitic as they were, had helped to undermine the democratic regime. Most professors were fanatical nationalists who wished the return of a conservative, monarchical Germany. And though to many of them, before 1933, the Nazis were too rowdy and violent to attract their allegiance, their preachments helped prepare the ground for the coming of Nazism. By 1932, the majority of students appeared to be enthusiastic for Hitler. It was surprising to some how many members of the university faculties knuckled under to the Nazification of higher learning after 1933. Though official figures put the number of professors and instructors dismissed during the first 5 years of the regime at 2,800, about one-fourth of the total number, the proportion of those who lost their posts through defying National Socialism was, as Professor Wilhelm Röpke, himself dismissed from the University of Marburg in 1933, said, exceedingly small. Though small, there were names famous in the German academic world: Karl Jaspers, E. I. Gumbel, Theodor Litt, Karl Barth, Julius Ebbinghaus, and dozens of others. Most of them emigrated, first to Switzerland, Holland, and England, and eventually to America. One of them, Professor Theodor Lessing, who had fled to Czechoslovakia, was tracked down by Nazi thugs and murdered in Marienbad on August 31, 1933. A large majority of professors, however, remained at their posts, and as early as the autumn of 1933, some 960 of them, led by such luminaries as Professor Sauerbruch, the surgeon, Heidegger, the existentialist philosopher, and Pinder, the art historian, took a public vow to support Hitler and the National Socialist regime. It was a scene of prostitution, Professor Röpke later wrote, that has stained the honorable history of German learning. And as Professor Julius Ebbinghaus, looking back over the shambles in 1945, said, the German universities failed, while there was still time, to oppose publicly with all their power the destruction of knowledge and of the democratic state. They failed to keep the beacon of freedom and right burning during the night of tyranny. The cost of such failure was great. After 6 years of Nazification, the number of university students dropped by more than one half, from 127,920 to 58,325. The decline in enrollment at the Institutes of Technology, from which Germany got its scientists and engineers, was even greater, from 20,474 to 9,554. Academic standards fell dizzily. By 1937, there was not only a shortage of young men in the sciences and engineering, but a decline in their qualifications. Long before the outbreak of the war, the chemical industry, busily helping to further Nazi rearmament, was complaining through its organ, Die Chemische Industrie, that Germany was losing its leadership in chemistry. Not only the national economy, but national defense itself was being jeopardized, it complained, and it blamed the shortage of young scientists and their mediocre caliber on the poor quality of the technical colleges. Nazi Germany's loss, as it turned out, was the free world's gain, especially in the race to be the first with the atom bomb. The story of the successful efforts of Nazi leaders, led by Himmler, to hamstring the atomic energy program is too long and involved to be recounted here. It was one of the ironies of fate that the development of the bomb in the United States owed so much to two men who had been exiled because of race from the Nazi and fascist dictatorships, Einstein from Germany and Fermi from Italy. To Adolf Hitler, it was not so much the public schools, from which he himself had dropped out so early in life, but the organizations of the Hitler Youth on which he counted to educate the youth of Germany for the ends he had in mind. In the years of the Nazi Party's struggle for power, the Hitler Youth movement had not amounted to much. In 1932, the last year of the Republic, its total enrollment was only 107,956, compared to some 10 million youths who belonged to the various organizations united in the Reich Committee of German Youth Associations. In no country in the world had there been a youth movement of such vitality and numbers as in Republican Germany. Hitler, realizing this, was determined to take it over and Nazify it. His chief lieutenant for this task was a handsome young man of banal mind but of great driving force, Baldur von Schirach, who, falling under Hitler's spell, had joined the party in 1925 at the age of 18, and in 1931 had been named youth leader of the Nazi Party. Among the scar-faced, brawling brown shirts, he had the curious look of an American college student, fresh and immature, and this perhaps was due to his having had, as we have seen, American forebears, including two signers of the Declaration of Independence. Schirach was named youth leader of the German Reich in June 1933. Aping the tactics of his elder party leaders, his first action was to send an armed band of 50 husky Hitler Youth men to occupy the national offices of the Reich Committee of German Youth Associations, where an old Prussian army officer, General Vogt, head of the committee, was put to rout. Schirach next took on one of the most celebrated of German naval heroes, Admiral von Trotha, who had been chief of staff of the High Seas Fleet in the First World War and who was now president of the Youth Associations. The venerable admiral, too, was put to flight, and his position and organization were dissolved. Millions of dollars worth of property, chiefly in hundreds of youth hostels scattered throughout Germany, was seized. The Concordat of July 20, 1933, had specifically provided for the unhindered continuance of the Catholic Youth Association. On December 1, 1936, Hitler decreed a law outlawing it and all other non-Nazi organizations for young people. All of the German youth in the Reich is organized within the Hitler Youth. The German youth, besides being reared within the family and schools, shall be educated physically, intellectually, and morally in the spirit of National Socialism through the Hitler Youth. Schirach, whose office had formerly been subordinate to the Ministry of Education, was made responsible directly to Hitler. This half-baked young man of 29, who wrote maudlin verse in praise of Hitler, this genius grazing the stars, and followed Rosenberg in his weird paganism and Stryker in his virulent anti-Semitism, had become the dictator of youth in the Third Reich. From the age of 6 to 18, when conscription for the labor service and the army began, girls as well as boys were organized in the various cadres of the Hitler Youth. Parents found guilty of trying to keep their children from joining the organization were subject to heavy prison sentences, even though, as in some cases, they merely objected to having their daughters enter some of the services where cases of pregnancy had reached scandalous proportions. From the age of 6 to 10, a boy served a sort of apprenticeship for the Hitler Youth as a pimpf. Each youngster was given a performance book in which would be recorded his progress through the entire Nazi youth movement, including his ideological growth. At 10, after passing suitable tests in athletics, camping, and Nazified history, he graduated into the Jungfolk, where he took the following oath. In the presence of this blood banner which represents our Führer, I swear to devote all my energies and my strength to the savior of our country, Adolf Hitler. I am willing and ready to give up my life for him, so help me God. At 14, the boy entered the Hitler Youth proper and remained there until he was 18, when he passed into the labor service and the army. It was a vast organization organized on paramilitary lines, similar to the SA, and in which the youngsters approaching manhood received systematic training not only in camping, sports, and Nazi ideology, but in soldiering. On many a weekend in the environs of Berlin, this writer would be interrupted in his picnicking by Hitler youths scrambling through the woods or over the heath, rifles at the ready and heavy army packs on their backs. Sometimes the young ladies would be playing at soldiering too, for the Hitler Youth movement did not neglect the maidens. From 10 to 14, German girls were enrolled as Jungmädel, literally young maidens, and they too had a uniform made up of a white blouse, full blue skirt, socks, and heavy, and most unfeminine, marching shoes. Their training was much like that of the boys of the same age and included long marches on weekends with heavy packs and the usual indoctrination in the Nazi philosophy. But emphasis was put on the role of women in the Third Reich, to be, above all, healthy mothers of healthy children. This was stressed even more when the girls became, at 14, members of the BDM, Bund Deutscher Mädel, League of German Maidens. At 18, several thousand of the girls in the BDM, they remained in it until 21, did a year's service on the farms, their so-called Landjahr, which was equivalent to the labor service of the young men. Their task was to help both in the house and in the fields. The girls lived sometimes in the farmhouses, and often in small camps in rural districts from which they were taken by truck early each morning to the farms. Moral problems soon arose. The presence of a pretty young city girl sometimes disrupted a peasant's household, and angry complaints from parents about their daughters having been made pregnant on the farms began to be heard. But that wasn't the only problem. Usually a girls' camp was located near a labor service camp for young men. This juxtaposition seems to have made for many pregnancies, too. One couplet, a takeoff on the strength through joy movement of the labor front, but it applied especially to the Landjahr of the young maidens, went the rounds of Germany. In the fields and on the heath, I lose strength through joy. Similar moral problems also arose during the household year for girls, in which some 500,000 Hitler Youth maidens spent a year at domestic service in a city household. Actually, the more sincere Nazis did not consider them moral problems at all. On more than one occasion, I listened to women leaders of the BDM, they were invariably of the plainer type and usually unmarried, lecture their young charges on the moral and patriotic duty of bearing children for Hitler's Reich, within wedlock if possible, but without it if necessary. By the end of 1938, the Hitler Youth numbered 7,728,259. Large as this number was, obviously some 4 million youth had managed to stay out of the organization, and in March 1939 the government issued a law conscripting all youth into the Hitler Youth on the same basis as they were drafted into the army. Recalcitrant parents were warned that their children would be taken away from them and put into orphanages or other homes, unless they enrolled. The final twist to education in the Third Reich came in the establishment of three types of schools for the training of the elite. The Adolf Hitler schools, under the direction of the Hitler Youth, the National Political Institutes of Education, and the Order Castles, the last two under the aegis of the party. The Adolf Hitler schools took the most promising youngsters from the Jungfolk at the age of 12, and gave them 6 years of intensive training for leadership in the party and in the public services. The pupils lived at the school under Spartan discipline, and on graduation were eligible for the university. There were 10 such schools founded after 1937, the principal one being the Academy at Brunswick. The purpose of the Political Institutes of Education was to restore the type of education formerly given in the old Prussian military academies. This, according to one official commentary, cultivated the soldierly spirit with its attributes of courage, sense of duty, and simplicity. To this was added special training in Nazi principles. The schools were under the supervision of the SS, which furnished the headmasters and most of the teachers. Three such schools were established in 1933 and grew to 31 before the outbreak of the war, three of them for women. At the very top of the pyramid were the so-called order castles, the Ordensburgen. In these, with their atmosphere of the castles of the Order of Teutonic Knights of the 14th and 15th centuries, were trained the elite of the Nazi elite. The knightly order had been based on the principle of absolute obedience to the master, the Ordensmeister, and devoted to the German conquest of the Slavic lands in the east and the enslavement of the natives. The Nazi order castles had similar discipline and purposes. Only the most fanatical young National Socialists were chosen, usually from the top ranks of the graduates of the Adolf Hitler schools and the political institutes. There were four castles, and a student attended successively all of them. The first of 6 years was spent in one which specialized in the racial sciences and other aspects of Nazi ideology. The emphasis was on mental training and discipline, with physical training subordinated to it. This was reversed the second year at a castle where athletics and sports, including mountain climbing and parachute jumping, came first. The third castle, where the students spent the next year and a half, offered political and military instruction. Finally, in the fourth and last stage of his education, the student was sent for a year and a half to the Ordensburg in Marienburg in East Prussia, near the Polish frontier. There, within the walls of the very order castle which had been a stronghold of the Teutonic Knights 5 centuries before, his political and military training was concentrated on the Eastern question and Germany's need and right of expanding into the Slavic lands in its eternal search for Lebensraum. An excellent preparation, as it turned out, and no doubt was meant to turn out, for the events of 1939 and thereafter. In such a manner were the youth trained for life and work and death in the Third Reich. Though their minds were deliberately poisoned, their regular schooling interrupted, their homes largely replaced so far as their rearing went, the boys and the girls, the young men and women, seemed immensely happy, filled with a zest for the life of a Hitler youth. And there was no doubt that the practice of bringing the children of all classes and walks of life together— where those who had come from poverty or riches, from a laborer's home or a peasant's or a businessman's or an aristocrat's, shared common tasks, was good and healthy in itself. In most cases, it did no harm to a city boy and girl to spend 6 months in the compulsory labor service, where they lived outdoors and learned the value of manual labor and of getting along with those of different backgrounds. No one who traveled up and down Germany in those days and talked with the young in their camps and watched them work and play and sing could fail to see that, however sinister the teaching, here was an incredibly dynamic youth movement. The young in the Third Reich were growing up to have strong and healthy bodies, faith in the future of their country and in themselves, and a sense of fellowship and camaraderie that shattered all class and economic and social barriers. I thought of that later, in the May days of 1940, when along the road between Aachen and Brussels, one saw the contrast between the German soldiers, bronzed and clean-cut from a youth spent in the sunshine on an adequate diet, and the first British war prisoners, with their hollow chests, round shoulders, pasty complexions, and bad teeth. Tragic examples of the youth that England had neglected so irresponsibly in the years between the wars. The farmer in the Third Reich. When Hitler came to power in 1933, the farmer, as in most countries, was in desperate straits. According to a writer in the Frankfurter Zeitung, his situation was worse than at any time since the disastrous Peasants' War of 1524-25 devastated the German land. Agricultural income in 1932-33 had fallen to a new low, more than a billion marks below the worst post-war year, 1924-25. The farmers were in debt to the amount of 12 billions, almost all of it incurred in the last 8 years. Interest on those debts took some 14% of all farm income, and to this was added a comparable burden in taxes and contributions to social services. My party comrades, make yourselves clear about one thing. There is only one final chance for the German peasantry, Hitler warned at the outset of his chancellorship. And in October 1933 he declared that the ruin of the German peasant will be the ruin of the German people. For years the Nazi Party had cultivated the backing of the farmers. Point 17 of the inalterable party program promised them land reform, a law for confiscation without compensation of land for common purposes, abolition of interest on farm loans, and prevention of all speculation in land. Like most of the other points of the program, the promises to the farmers were not kept, with the exception of the last provision against land speculation. In 1938, after 5 years of Nazi rule, land distribution remained more lopsided than in any other country in the West. Figures published that year in the official statistical yearbook showed that the smallest 2.5 million farms had less land than the top 0.1%. The Nazi dictatorship, like the socialist bourgeois governments of the Republic, did not dare to break up the immense feudal estates of the Junkers, which lay to the east of the Elbe. Nevertheless, the Nazi regime did inaugurate a sweeping new farm program accompanied by much sentimental propaganda about Blut und Boden, blood and soil, and the peasants being the salt of the earth and the chief hope of the Third Reich. To carry it out, Hitler appointed Walter Dare, one of the few party leaders who, though he subscribed to most of the Nazi myths, knew his field professionally and well. An outstanding agricultural specialist with suitable academic training, he had served in the agriculture ministries of Prussia and the Reich. Forced to leave them because of conflicts with his superiors, he retired to his home in the Rhineland in 1929 and wrote a book entitled The Peasantry as the Life Source of the Nordic Race. Such a title was bound to attract the attention of the Nazis. Rudolf Hess brought Dare to Hitler, who was so impressed with him that he commissioned him to draw up a suitable farm program for the party. With Hugenberg's dismissal in June 1933, Dare became Minister of Food and Agriculture. By September, he was ready with his plans to make over German agriculture. Two basic laws promulgated in that month reorganized the entire structure of production and marketing, with a view to ensuring higher prices for farmers, and at the same time put the German peasant on a new footing, accomplishing this paradoxically by putting him back on a very old footing in which farms were entailed, as in feudal days, and the farmer and successive inheritors compulsorily attached to their particular plot of soil, provided they were Aryan Germans, to the end of time. The Hereditary Farm Law of September 29, 1933, was a remarkable mixture of pushing back the peasants to medieval days and of protecting them against the abuses of the modern monetary age. All farms up to 308 acres, 125 hectares, which were capable of providing a decent living for a family, were declared to be hereditary estates subject to the ancient laws of entailment. They could not be sold, divided, mortgaged, or foreclosed for debts. Upon the death of the owner, they had to be passed on to the oldest or youngest son, in accordance with local customs, or to the nearest male relative, who was obliged to provide a living and an education for his brothers and sisters until they were of age. Only an Aryan German citizen who could prove the purity of his blood back to 1800 could own such a farm. And only such a man, the law stipulated, could bear the honored title Bauer, or peasant, which he forfeited if he broke the Peasant Honor Code, or ceased, because of incapacity or otherwise, to actively farm. Thus, the heavily indebted German farmer, at the beginning of the Third Reich, was protected from losing his property by foreclosures, or from seeing it shrink in size, there being no necessity to sell a piece of it to repay a debt. But at the same time, he was bound to the soil as irrevocably as the serfs of feudal times. And every aspect of his life and work was strictly regulated by the Reich Food Estate, which Dare established by a law of September 13, 1933, a vast organization with authority over every conceivable branch of agricultural production, marketing, and processing, and which he himself headed in his capacity of Reich Peasant Leader. Its chief objectives were two: to obtain stable and profitable prices for the farmer, and to make Germany self-sufficient in food. How well did it succeed? In the beginning, certainly, the farmer, who for so long had felt himself neglected in a state which seemed to be preoccupied with the interests of business and labor, was flattered to be singled out for so much attention and proclaimed a national hero and an honored citizen. He was more pleased at the rise in prices which Staré obtained for him by simply arbitrarily fixing them at a profitable level. In the first 2 years of Nazi rule, wholesale agricultural prices increased by 20%. In vegetables, dairy products, and cattle, the rise was a little more. But this advantage was partially offset by a similar rise in the things which the farmer had to buy, above all in machinery and fertilizer. As for self-sufficiency in food, which was deemed necessary by the Nazi leaders, who already, as we shall see, were plotting war, the goal was never achieved, nor, given the quality and quantity of German soil in relation to its population, could it ever be. The best the country could do, despite all Nazi efforts in the much-advertised battle of production, was to reach 83% of self-sufficiency, and it was only by the conquest of foreign lands that the Germans obtained enough food to enable them to hold out during the Second War as long as they did.